It's season two of the Carson McCullough Center's weekly We of Me. This is the second of three episodes based on our interview with Columbus, Georgia native, Carson McCullough scholar, and Major McCullough Center benefactor, Dr. Thornton Jerdon.
This segment of the interview has been edited for time and content.
You were instrumental in creating an interactive map called Carson McCullough's is Columbus, right, which is available, ladies and gentlemen, on the Carson McCullough Center's website. Can you tell us about that project?
That took a lot of digging. Callie McGinnis, who was the librarian at Columbus College, helped me put that together, the text, the images, and all that. But it was to go around to all the sites that still existed that had been alluded to in her works. And a majority of them were in downtown Columbus, where she was born and was lived until she was 9 years old. Her father continued to work downtown. And downtown Columbus, which is about the size of the French Quarter, that's all there was to Columbus. The rest of it was a gradual development of suburbs like the one she lived in. So I went around and photographed every site that was still standing and made a little map so you could either do a driving tour or a walking tour of these locations.
Well, one of them that I always like to point out to people is that garage apartment of Edwin Peacock's that is still there by the museum. The house that was there is gone, but the garage apartment is there.
Right.
And of course, my understanding is that Edwin and Carson, and I think maybe even at some point Reeves, spent a lot of time there listening to records and talking about art and so forth.
Yeah, it was Edwin who introduced Carson to Reeves. He knew him through Fort Benning, and he got them together, and they hit it off beautifully.
What else would you say about Columbus during Carson's lifetime? I mean, you just said a lot about the fact that the downtown, that was pretty much it. And, you know, what we now term Midtown, where the Smith McCullough's house is, that was the burbs. What are some other impressions that you have of Columbus of that period?
Well, Columbus is here because of we're on the fall line, and it was the water power of the Chattahoochee River that made possible all these factories, including the textile mill. So we were basically a textile town, and pretty much everything else was in service of the mills. So there were mill towns, shotgun houses, where laborers worked. They weren't paid very much. That was one facet of the town. There was the historic district where the richer people had built prominent homes along the four main parallel streets to the river. That was a two-class society, not so much of a middle class. And she, Carson said, she just walked and talked a lot. She walked in every neighborhood, black neighborhoods, milltown neighborhoods, downtown neighborhoods, suburbs, and stop people on the street and talk to them. And she was just omnivorous in her curiosity about other people's lives.
One of the questions some people ask me when they come to the Smith McCullough's house, they'll say, were they rich? You know, I'm at a loss to answer that question, because you look at that house, and it seems to me, my sense of that, the house was built, what, in the teens or early 20s, I guess?
About 1917. In fact, I didn't remember this. One of my aunts was the first owner of that house, and she sold it to Lamar Smith about 1926. Yeah, it's a curious house. It's in a neighborhood where there are lots of craftsman-style bungalow homes, and I always thought it was a two-story house. But it's not. It's a one-story, except it's got about 11-foot ceilings in it.
Right.
So very, very spacious. Yeah, that was a middle-class neighborhood. You know, her father, he was a jeweler and an engraver who worked for another shop to begin with, and then eventually had three or four shops on his own, and a watchmaker. My aunt said he was really good. He could build a watch from scratch. And, of course, he engraved a lot of silver for people in Columbus, but they certainly weren't rich.
So he was part, I guess, then what we're saying is, of a pretty small middle class here in Columbus. It was mostly, like you said, the division between those laborers and those people who owned the mills. Could you say something for our listeners about your own family's history in Columbus?
The move to Columbus was from Sparta, Georgia, which is in middle Georgia. And the first guy who came, the original Gunby Jerdon, he was a young man, and he was recruited during the Civil War to join a cavalry that was being organized in Columbus, fought in the war the whole time, came back. And he was a very enterprising fellow, and he got involved in everything. textiles and banking and insurance and real estate and riverboats and railroads and education. He was instrumental in the first school in Columbus that taught industrial arts. A lot of that was trying to provide educational opportunities for people who were working in the mills. But he was kind of a distant relative. His brother was my great-great-grandfather. That ancestor was not as enterprising as as G. Gunby. So we're on a less prominent side of the family.
You were talking about, Jordan High School, right? Yeah. And my understanding was that is the first industrial high school in America.
Well, I didn't know. It could be.
That's what I've heard on a number of occasions, and it's still operating over in that neighborhood. Well, thank you for saying that. I was always curious about exactly what the relation was between your side of the family and Jay Gunby. Jordan, I've had the pleasure to give house tours of the Smith McCullers house here in Columbus, and even to a lesser extent, the Carson McCullers house in Nyack, New York, to people from all over the world, people from all walks of life, as we say, and to a number of well-known people, Karen Allen, Rachel Weiss and her husband, Daniel Craig, Suzanne Vega, New Yorker critic Hilton Alls. One of my predecessors as director of the center, our mutual friend, Kathy Fussell, once gave a tour of the house here in Columbus to former First Lady Laura Bush. It must be gratifying to you to have provided that opportunity for so many people. But is it also a little surprising to you that the house has become such a draw for a sort of certain kind of literary tourist?
No, I'm not surprised, but all the credit for this goes to Carlos Dues. The house had come up on the market twice, and I missed it the first time. The second time it came up, and I bought it, and I offered it to Historic Columbus, but they turned it down. It's too far away from their downtown concentration. And then it was Carlos who had the vision to make this a center for writers and musicians and offer fellowships and all that. And he came up with the proposal. We approached Columbus College at the time, and they were interested, but they had a big fund drive going on, and it took them 5 years to actually take possession of it. I think what Carlos imagined about it is what came true about it. And I'm not surprised at all, given the importance of Carson McCullers, that we're getting this kind of interest in it. It was long overdue.
It's long overdue. I would say that for sure. The biographer, Mary Dearborn, whose most recent book is on Ernest Hemingway, and she was thus one of the interviewees on Ken Burns' documentary that just aired on PBS this spring. I don't know if you saw that, Thornton, but she's interviewed several times.
Right.
And she is now putting the finishing touches on her biography of Carson McCullers, which is going to come out from Knopf probably next year, I think. And she will be here in just a few weeks, staying in the Smith McCullers house for the third time and doing work in the archives. She's now, she's to the point where she's selecting the photographs that are going to be included in the book. And that's why she's coming this last time, because the book is done and it's, she's going through the process with her editors and everything.
I'm eager to read it.
Yeah, I am too. I really am eager to read it. And I know, because you knew Virginia Carr well, that you read with a critical eye all all subsequent biographies of McCullers. And in fact, all the biographers that I have talked to, and then even people like Jen Chaplin, who wrote this My Autobiography of Carson McCullers, admit that if you're going to write about the life of Carson McCullers, you're going to lean heavily on the work of Virginia Spencer Carr, because she interviewed so many people and did so much of the legwork. But at any rate, Mary Dearborn, I had her on the podcast earlier this season, and she was very interested in Carson's recollection of her attempted sexual encounter with Anne-Marie Clorox Schwarzenbach in the transcriptions from the dictaphone recordings she made while under the care of Dr. Mary Mercer, an artifact that you have also studied closely. What, in your opinion, is the importance of that artifact?
Let me say a couple of things first. Virginia interviewed all the people who knew Carson McCullers, who was still alive, and now all those people are dead. Yeah. So the primary sources are just not available. I thought the Savigno biography, in which she had permission from the estate that Virginia Carr never had to go through the material, I really didn't learn much from it. It didn't add very much. So I kind of think all subsequent biographies are going to just have to be interpretive biographies. The one thing they will have that Virginia Carr did not have are these tapes from the therapy sessions. I worked with them when they first came in, but we only had 5 weeks worth of therapy. I assume more has come in since then, and I need to get back to them. But I did want to talk about the Anne Marie relationship and how Carson processed that relationship. In the therapy session, she tells this very dramatic episode where it's the only instance I know of where Carson was about to have sex with another woman, and it went terribly wrong. So the story was, Anne Marie, you know, was a morphine addict, and she was staying in New York with a couple of friends in a small apartment, and Carson showed up and noticed that the telephone was hanging out the window. So she asked the friend, Freddie, what happened, and he said Anne Marie had tried to call Dr. Margaret Opel, who had been a physician and a lover of hers. She didn't get any answer and was frustrated and threw the phone out the window. Then Anne Marie told Carson to take her clothes off, which she did, and she was sexually aroused and climbed into bed, but then it went horribly wrong. Anne Marie screamed at her that she didn't want her, that she was too skinny. And she said, go bring me Gypsy Rose Lee. And then she commanded Carson to go find her some morphine. Carson had no clue how to go find morphine. So she called Dr. Margaret Opel in Florida and asked her, what should I do? And Dr. Opel said, run. Anne Marie is dangerous. She will kill you. She tried to strangle me and my husband, and we fled to Florida. And Carson said, well, maybe I should bring her down there so you could treat her. And she says, do not bring her to Florida. Tell her that we have put barbed wire around the house and that we have a night watchman. You get out of there. Well, of course, Carson couldn't tell Anne Marie about that end of the conversation. So she just said Margot couldn't talk to her. And at that point, Anne Marie tries to commit suicide. She slashes her wrist and her throat. And Freddie says to Carson, go find a doctor. She goes out to a nearby hotel to try to find a doctor and bumps into a policeman and says, somebody's tried to commit suicide and I'm trying to find a doctor. Can you tell me how to find one? The policeman blew a whistle. Other police came. And when Carson got back to the apartment with a doctor, there were several policemen in there. And Anne Marie accused Carson of trying to punish her by bringing the police. Carson protests. The police take her away and she's institutionalized. From the institution, she writes to Carson to say, don't send flowers, go home, go home, go back to your parents, go home, which Carson does. There's more to the story. Anne Marie escapes from the institution, spends a night in the woods, manages to hail a cab, and makes her way back to New York City where some friends take her in. But when it's discovered where she is, a doctor with another guy shows up with a warrant, and she is reinstitutionalized. She finally got permission from a judge to be released, and she agreed to go back to Europe, basically to exile herself. She goes to Europe, then to Africa, comes back to Europe, and sadly has a bicycle accident and a head injury, and she dies from it. Now, that's a very dramatic thing, but I'm less interested in the drama and the sexual frustration and all that than what Carson does in processing that. She says in a therapy session to Dr. Mercer that it was only after Anne Marie's death that I finally had her. And here's the quote. I didn't know I never had Anne Marie until Klaus Mann wired me that she was dead. I knew I had her then. She would never leave me again. I saw her blessed face and rejoiced that she would never be hurt again and that she was safe now in my heart. I lived in her for my work. This is an interesting move that she has interjected Anne Marie, who had rejected her grievously, and takes her into that inner room where she can be forever protected and idealized by Carson McCullers. Just one more little bit. If you think about this in relation to her famous definition of love, and many of your guests have quoted from it, the key idea in there was that the suffering lover, quote, must create for himself a whole new inward world, a world intense and strange, complete in himself. This is the private room. This is not about mature adult reciprocal love relationships. This is a space to which Carson McCullers repaired, where she could guard her idealized lovers. And I think they all were projections and idealized lovers, so that they were the source of her inspiration. It all gets turned into literature. And I think this is Carson McCullers' muse. She repaired to this room over and over and over at any cost. And I think all relationships in her outer life were at the service of that inner room.
I have often had a similar opinion. I think it's related to what you're saying, which was, for Carson, it's a lot less about the physical relationship than it is about something else. What I'm hearing is it's an idealized sort of relationship. Also, to me, a relationship that it's more soul to soul, if you will, as cliched as that may sound, that she's interested in. You know, it's a different kind of connection, less a physical one, more a spiritual one, if you like.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think there are desperate attachments to some person in the outer world that will make her feel whole. And I would say, because of that, and there's such a long series of them, men and women, that they're all doomed, because they are all projections of how she imagined they could make her emotionally whole. So in some ways they're real people, in some ways they are contracts that Carson is making with other codependent people. And when codependent, you know, so you get one partner who needs to be adored, loved, admired, and taken care of. And the other partner is the one who needs to adore, love, take care of, to need to be needed. And when these relationships are working well, they're fine. Problem occurs when one partner becomes more independent and moves out of the relationship. And then the other partner, it's not just disappointment. It's not like, well, they weren't getting their needs met, they need to move on, it's painful, but I wish them well. Is the partner who's left feels betrayed. They feel abandoned. They feel deep depression and even suicidal despair. That's the classic definition of codependent relationships. And again, I think the reason they exist is, you go back to the root, is there's just a tremendous lack of basic trust and self-worth at the core that, I think comes out of very early childhood problems.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting in your theory about that, that it is a function of the alcoholic family that she grew up in. It's a possibility, and it certainly makes sense to me that it could be, yeah.
But the other side of the equation, here's the problem with my thesis. It doesn't explain the genius. And one way it does, because Carson McCullers lacked boundaries, and she didn't respect other people's boundaries as well. Many people comment on that. In fact, Ann Baxter said Carson McCullers was a skinless person. And that's what Mary Mercer admired about him. She thought Carson McCullers was an exceptional human being because she came forward into adulthood with all the vulnerabilities and all the candor of a child. And many people refer to her as a child woman. It's a wound and a handicap. At the same time, it's a tremendous gift that she had that ability to just penetrate right to the core, through the surface and right to the core of other people's spirit and reach them. And again, I think that's why so many readers say, here's the writer who understands me.
You know, as I was saying earlier, I've given the house tour to people from all over the world, and that's one of the things that you get. And it is a thrilling thing to see.
Yes.
When you realize that, oh, well, as I've said on this podcast a number of times, and it's absolutely true, that I have had people weep when they're in that house, especially when they go in her bedroom. And I say, well, this was Carson's bedroom. And they say, I'm sorry, I just can't hold it in. And it's because you can tell that they feel a profound connection to her. You know,
yes.
And it's like the actress Rachel Weisz said to me, I read Remember the Wedding, and it was like she knew who I was. She knew what it was like to be an adolescent girl. And there it was on the page. And, you know, she says she's been dear to my heart ever since, is what Rachel Weisz said. So,
absolutely. I totally understand that. That's her gift.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Carson McCullers Center's weekly We of Me. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find more at mccullerscenter.org or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. This podcast was brought to you by Columbus State University's Carson McCullers Center for Writers and Musicians and by Columbus State University's recording studio. The music you heard during the intro and outro was written by Lilia Uge in honor of Carson McCullers' 100th birthday on February 19th, 2017. I'm Nick Williams, technical director for these podcasts, and I hope you have a great day. The source materials for Thornton Jordan's discussion of Carson McCullers' relationship with Anne-Marie Cleric Schwarzenbach, including the transcription from McCullers' therapy sessions with Dr. Mary Mercer, are in the Columbus State University archives. The music you heard during the reading was Equinox by Tori Takamitsu, performed live in Legacy Hall by Jonathan Clark on October 21st, 2019.